Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is the founder and CEO of Good Loop, Amy Williams. Good Loop has a really interesting value proposition. They make it easy and profitable for big brands to do good at scale through good media. That's a mouthful, Amy, and we're going to want to dig into exactly what that means. But I love the way that you position the brand. I have such an interesting background, Amy, so many places to start, but I thought we would start where we share something, which is working as interns. I started my career as an intern, and I note that you worked as an intern at one of the legendary shops, Ogilvy and Mather. So I thought that might be sort of an interesting place to start.
Oh, I love that. I started my career on the internship at Ogilvy, which was an incredible way to start your career. What an amazing grounding. I mean, Ogilvy teaches you all of the foundations of how to build a brand. But I actually, even before that, had an internship. When I was 15 years old, I got myself a week internship at Mediacom, and I had no idea what media buying was. I didn't have a clue, but I got this week, and I remember so clearly that the internship was in London and I lived outside of London. And my dad said, right, you need a suit. You know, no daughter of mine is turning out in those scruffy jeans. So he marched me to, you know, Walmart, and he bought me like this cheap, ill-fitting plastic suit. And I turn up on day one, and as I'm sure you know, people at media agencies don't wear suits. They are dressed very trendy, very cool. And I turn up in this like nylon squeaky little suit. And because I wasn't where I live, because I was in a hotel in London, all I'd brought is that suit. So I had to wear it the whole week and be this weird 15-year-old dressed as like someone's grandma. Oh my God, it was so embarrassing. But yeah, made me the woman I am today.
And I would say the same about the internships that I had. That whatever degree of success I have had, I trace right back to those. So you started as a teenager at Mediacom. I remember when I was in my teens, I was very interested in Wall Street. I thought I was going to be in high finance. And my grandfather, who was an immigrant, came through Ellis Island, was a house painter. He was an investor in the stock market, and I took an interest in it through him. And I got an internship. It wasn't even really an internship, Amy. I think they used to let me come and hang around, and they sort of recognized I wasn't going to go away. It was a firm, I don't know if they're still around, called Sherman and Ralston. And that was when I was the same age when you were at Mediacom. And then I did proper internships as part of my university schooling in Atlanta at Emory, working in the Chamber of Commerce and the newspaper, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. But I look back on all of those experiences so fondly. Talk about how those things, Mediacom and then later at Ogilvy, how that really helped ground you and build that Amy Williams Foundation.
I think it speaks to the power of accessibility for young people. You know, like the way it's shaped you, the way that you feel, you know, a gratitude to that opportunity. I feel the exact same way. And it's so important for all of us now in our careers to remember how impactful it is. That week of me making a fool of myself at Mediacom, it taught me so much about how to conduct myself, you know, the language that people spoke, the priorities that clients really focus on, so that when I finished my college degree and I knew I wanted to work in advertising, I could apply for the jobs like the internship at Ogilvy. And you know, I was doing such simple tasks. I remember when I first started at Ogilvy, one of my jobs, a very important job, was to check the fonts on the British Airways Exec Club emails. Because if you're gold tier and you've got this gold status, it's a very posh Times New Roman font. And if you're bronze, it's like italics and much more like you're going places. So the fonts were very, very important. And I famously let an email go out to 10 million Exec Club members with the bronze font on a gold tier email, which was a fireable offense, but I think I managed to get out of it. But I remember, you know, learning about how important these details are when you're building a brand, when you're building something consistent and recognizable and trustworthy. You know, these elements that are so simple you don't notice them, the power of them is that you don't even notice how much work has gone into them. Like, I just think it built a real respect for the craft, and also a respect for proofreading.
And you worked on some pretty big brands. You mentioned BA, but you also worked on some Unilever brands.
Unilever actually was a very informative one for me because it was the team that created Dove Sketches and a lot of the very iconic work around Dove's Real Beauty campaign. I mean, Ogilvy, you know, of course, was the genesis of the Real Beauty campaign. And I just think it's such a brilliant example of our industry being used in the right way. You know, soap is so incredibly boring. No one wants to talk about soap, but you become the biggest soap brand in the world by talking about something that matters, that's inspiring and interesting and important, like self-esteem. And the thing is, you know, Unilever is so huge and influential and global that when Unilever decides to do good, when Unilever decides to build a brand that's about empowering real women and championing real beauty, you know, that their self-esteem project has touched the lives of over 29 million young women and girls. And I think that is what drives me today. The idea that you can help big corporates do good at scale is more impactful than one lifetime will ever be.
So well said. Talk about that culture at Ogilvy. They are still to this day, even in an era where a lot of the training and a lot of the programs that the agencies used to have investing in young people have gone, Ogilvy is still really viewed as a great, great place to be at the start of a career.
I remember it was drilled into you, the Ogilvy quotes. Everybody was expected to read all the Ogilvy books and know the Ogilvy quotes. And I think, you know, it is so important to have that sense of identity in an agency. I remember there was one in particular that I've always loved, which was a billboard is the worst form of advertising, because when you see an ad in the newspaper, it's paying that journalist's salary. And when you see an ad on a bus stop, it's paying to keep your head dry. There's a value exchange between advertising and the society it operates within. And billboards lose that value exchange. It's just an ad. And I think that you could argue either way, but the idea is a very, very powerful one. The idea is our role in society is important. The things our ads fund are important. And that's something I learned at Ogilvy. That's something I think the Ogilvy way really embeds in you. It's like, what's the value exchange with the consumer? How do you add value to the consumer, to their lives, and to the society they're a part of? Going into a year of elections, going into a year where 49% of the world's population will be voting in some election this year. You know, what's the role of advertising? What's the role of our industry in funding the free journalism that holds truth to power and the open internet that kind of keeps our democracies alive? I just think it's a really inspiring idea.
All right, I'm going to come back to that notion of an open internet and how it keeps our democracies alive. I have grave concerns about our country's democracy and how a lot of those technologies envisioned for one purpose have been turned for another. So let's put that aside. We'll come back to it. That's a little bit of a heavier topic. So I want to talk about Collider and the birth of Good Loop, but let's go back to the earliest remembrance or what a moment in time, a catalyst where the seed was planted. How early do the roots of Good Loop go back in the Amy Williams canon?
I remember going for a run when I was probably 23, and I was out on a run and I turned my music off because I'd had this idea and it was spinning and spinning and spinning. And so I thought, stop listening to Beyonce and actually spend this run thinking about this idea. And I came home and I remember my housemate had some dinner ready and I was like, no, I'll keep it in the oven. I have to write this down. And I quickly had to grab a piece of paper and like scribble, like a beautiful mind's beautiful genius. And it was a totally different idea, really. It was a sort of like a Snapchat for movie titles or something. But it felt good to have an idea. It felt exciting to start like thinking about the next tiny little step to make it real. And I remember I spent the whole weekend like downloading different softwares and different tools to help me wireframe the app and build a business model and all of this stuff. I had no idea what I was doing, but it was just still playing around with these words, like seeing how they felt in my mouth. And then I went into my job and I asked my boss if I could take her through it, you know, over a lunch break. And it felt so exciting. I think that's the moment I sort of started to realize I wanted to be an entrepreneur. It was the way that every time I said it out loud, every time I got a tiny step closer, every time someone gave me feedback on it, or told me it was wrong, or suggested someone else to speak to, it felt like building this precious little new delicate thing. And it was such an addictive feeling.
I love that story. And it sounds like a passion for the advertising business going back to your, 15-year-old self and working at Mediacom, and that passion for entrepreneurship sort of all came together.
Yeah. And fundamentally, someone that was sort of growing up in our industry in like 2014 to 2017, like ad blocking was the number one thing everyone was talking about. Now it's sort of plateaued and about a third of the internet is just unreachable. But at the time it was growing year on year. It was coined by the Times as the biggest boycott in human history. And to love an industry so deeply and to see that the people we thought we were talking to were opting out, it felt like something was broken. And I think that's always the driver of all entrepreneurs, isn't it? Is to find something that's broken and try and fix it.
Absolutely. And you were also at Ogilvy at a time when things were still going pretty well. WPP's health was a little bit different in that time period than it is today. I think Mark Reed and his team continue to fight the good fight. But as a point of fact, the business has just gotten a lot smaller. Talk about culture there. And I guess at that point, kind of nobody really knew what was coming.
You always in the moment have this sort of grass is greener sense. I remember a lot of the older creative teams sort of reminiscing for better days, even when I was new in the agency. I think there was definitely a golden era in the 80s and 90s where it was a very glamorous place and there was a lot of sex, drugs, rock and roll. By the time I got there, there was very little of the first two and a little bit of awkward secret to sex and then the company toilets or whatever, you'd hear about the next day after a party. Like, it still felt exciting and it still felt fun. I remember there was a bar in the office as like a fresh out of college grad. Like, that felt so huge. Felt so awesome that I could just go and have a drink after work and it was subsidized beer. Wow. I don't have the context of now. I left that world behind and now I work much more in the media side of things, much more on the tech side of things, where there is still a huge amount of funding and a huge amount of growth and capital. But certainly the creative side of our industry has been squeezed.
Well, listen, it's moved to other places, right? I mean, digital is, of course, the biggest variable, but the rise of the independent shops, and you've got so many, boutique, small, mid-sized firms that are doing incredible work. I think the holding companies still have a place in the world, but it's a different place than it was 10 years ago, certainly.
I agree with that. Yeah. And now it's sort of looking down the barrel of a creative world where AI informs so much of the decision making. It's about to go through a whole host of other changes that I think is very daunting.
Let's talk about Collider because it's such a unique program. I love that's how you sort of came into being. But give us the story there because it's so interesting.
Yeah, Collider is a ad tech specific angel investment group based in London. And I found out that they were accepting applicants for their next cohort. I knew I needed to meet Rose Lewis. Rose Lewis was the founder of Collider. She led the fund along with her partner, Andy Tate. And the two of them were this sort of powerhouse in London ad tech. They funded all of the big up and coming ad tech companies. So I saw that Rose Lewis was speaking at a conference, creatively named Ad Tech London. And she was the keynote. So I reached out to the conference and I blagged my way into being there like social media manager for this event. I couldn't afford a ticket, obviously, just quit my job and was pulling pints at a local pub. Like, I definitely couldn't afford a £500 industry conference, but I offered to do their social media and in exchange, I would get to go to the event. And as part of the social media, obviously I had to interview Rose Lewis. I mean, that went without saying, I had to interview the keynote. So it gave me this amazing opportunity to pitch her. And I remember at the time, her reaction was definitely a little bit pissed off initially, being brought in under the pretenses of this social media interview and then ending up getting pitched by some random entrepreneur. It wasn't how she'd planned to spend her day, I'm sure. But she gave me some honest feedback. She told me what wasn't right and what wasn't going to work and why she wasn't going to invest. And I went away I thought about it, I worked on it, I found a few early customers, and then I pitched properly. I formally applied to Collider, and we were accepted onto their 2018 cohort, which was game changing. I mean, it was a small amount of money. They invested £40,000, but it was enough to start paying myself. It was enough to fund some early innovation and hire a developer. It was enough to get to that first step, that first little step of having an MVP, something you can take out to market. It was the reason Good Youth exists today. And still, some of the investors from Collider, because they were, you know, industry specific, they are still some of my closest advisors and mentors, you know, 7 years later. So yeah, it was a game-changing opportunity.
And did Rose know that it was you when they were accepted? Was that connection remade, or did it just fall by the wayside?
I think so. I mean, certainly I made sure in the application to illustrate the fact I'd heard the feedback and change, like changes in the adaptations that I'd made. I think as an early stage investor, really what you're looking at is the founder. Like, the idea is going to change, the market's going to change, everything else will change, but the founder is the thing you're investing in at that stage. And so it was really important to me to show that I could learn and listen. And I think that's what helped them decide to back us.
And does that come naturally to you, or do you have to work for it? You know, I have to work often to keep my mouth shut in a conversation and let everybody else talk and do a better job of listening. And I make a conscious effort to do that. You seem like a pretty strong-willed person. Do you take that advice easily, or is it hard for you?
I think one of the benefits of being a very young founder, I started my business at 25. And one of the benefits of being a young founder is that you know you're not the smartest person in the room. You know you need help. And the only way you're going to succeed is if you can build a network of people who around you who are more experienced and more connected than you are. So from a very early stage of my career, I really learned the value of listening to others. And I, even now as a leader of my company, I have an incredible C-suite of people who are all far more talented and able to do their jobs than I am. And I've had to slowly hand over the reins. You know, at the beginning, I was doing the finance and the legals and the marketing. And now I have a CFO and a CMO who are both better than I ever was. And so my job is to just tell them the right direction and be there to sort of back them and to trust their expertise. So I definitely think it's been a skill I've had to learn to get good at. I think the counter, the almost exact opposite is also true. As a young female founder, I have received a lot of unsolicited advice. A lot of people think they know better than me. A lot of people think that they can run my business better than I can. And another really important skill of any founder is to filter advice based on who it's coming from. Often advice is just a way for people to reflect on their own decisions and their own context, and often doesn't take into account the million things that you have to consider when you are making decisions that affect the livelihoods of the people you employ. So I've had to take a little bit of caution when I'm listening to others as well, if I'm honest.
Very fair. So you're about 6 years in. What has surprised you the most going back to your initial vision? And if you could have a do-over on part of the business, what would it be?
Ooh. What surprised me the most? I've been bowled over by the kindness of people. I have had so many people over the course of that 7 years who went out of their way to be a cheerleader, you know, make an introduction they didn't need to, or take time with me to refine something that wasn't quite right, or those little lifts up that someone can offer you when they are in a position of power. It's kind of like what we were saying at the beginning with the internships. You know, you can easily underestimate how important those little steps up are, and turning back and lifting someone up behind you. Yeah, I can list at least 20 people who have single-handedly had a game-changing effect on my company and my trajectory because of a tiny little moment of kindness. I think if I could do a do-over, oh man, there's so many. Oh, I've made a lot of mistakes along the way, and I don't know if I regret them. I would have, I mean, this one is kind of only possible in hindsight, maybe, but I definitely didn't take the pandemic seriously enough soon enough. And the uncertainty and fear that that caused for my company, like, of the, oh, do we go in the office? Don't we? Like, traveling. And in retrospect, I feel I put people at risk and we should have just been way more decisive earlier about how serious that was. So, yeah, there's definitely some moments I'd do over. I think also we've just invested in a big rebrand, which was terrifying. I mean, it's a lot of money. It's a huge change. You know, your brand is such a big part of the equity that you build. And Goodloop is well known. I mean, here in the States, we're still a couple of years old, but in the UK, we're very established. So yeah, that was super scary. And having now been through it and done that repositioning, I love that you mentioned you liked our positioning. Thank you. Having done that repositioning work, having got this sexy, new, impactful, bold, fresh brand, I have seen the energy as injected into this company, like the belief everyone feels, that the empowerment it's created. And I wish I'd done it 5 years ago. I think that's something I could have benefited from a few years ahead of me when we did it.
You probably weren't ready 5 years ago. And I think one of the great measures is, if you had the same set of facts, would you make the same decision? And that doesn't mean that you're always going to be right. Certainly, I can point to lots of moments in my career where a wrong decision was made. But based on what I knew at that time, I would make the same decision again. And listen, the pandemic, nobody knew, right? We all thought it would be a few weeks. None of us imagined, you know, what we were in store for. We were, when it really started to hit, we did one of six planned global editions of Advertising Week in 2020. We did Mexico the very first week in March. And that was when Boris Johnson was saying, you know, sing happy birthday and wash your hands. And, you know, nobody knew. And we still thought the London event, which was a couple weeks later, would go forward. And then we made a decision, you know, post Mexico to postpone ultimately. You know, we didn't get back there until the spring of 22. But I don't know that you can hold yourself too badly to account there. Nobody knew what we were in for.
Yeah, I was in New York planning to go to South by Southwest. And then I remember Trump closed the border and I was on an emergency repatriation flight. I mean, we've all got those stories. You're right. I couldn't have known. Yeah, I remember a conversation with one of my team when I got back from the States. And I think in the UK, it had been a bit more serious, a bit longer. In the States, we're sort of catching up. It came to the States later. So because I'd been in America, I came back and I was like, no one has to be in, but I'm going to be in on Monday. And then obviously everyone was in. And one of my colleagues came up to me and they were like, you're the CEO. If you say you're in, everyone's in and we're all terrified, like go home. And it was just that moment of realizing, I think because I'm the founder and the CEO and that transition between the two is something I've never quite got my head around. Like as a founder, I'm one of you. Indeed, I'm the one that's going to stay latest and clean the desks at the end of the night. And as the CEO, there's a power dynamic that I shouldn't underestimate.
No, very well said. And I think, listen, it's clear from talking to you that you're a passionate leader and that brings a lot of responsibility. And in effect, you're the den mother looking after all the other cubs and they look to you in that way. So when you talk about the business of doing good and purpose and profit not being at odds, I always go back to Paul Polman and Unilever, who I think in so many ways was early to the dance. And the brands that they and their marketing leader at that time, terrific guy, Keith Weed, really did such a brilliant job in explaining to consumers and to Wall Street that you could wrap brands, in this case, around sustainability and also still make money. And I think brands overall are really, really running towards that door today. One of my dear friends, the global CMO of MasterCard, Raja Menar, very passionate speaker, and the World Federation of Advertisers, which he leads as their president, very passionate about the role, the responsibility, the opportunity that brands have to impact real issues. Talk about that evolution and the role that Goodloop is playing in that ecosystem.
I think you're absolutely right. Keith Weed and Paul Polman were pioneers in this space. And It makes sense because they do sell boring products. I think when you're trying to sell soap and fabric conditioner, you need to find a way to connect with consumers. That means when they're at that shelf, there's something deeper and more emotional than price. And whenever I talk to brands about purpose or social impact or responsibility, whatever they call it, you know, it is always the third thing. It's always the third thing. First is price. Second is efficacy. Third is what do you give a shit about? It's always the third thing. But three things is still a very justifiable amount of things to consider when you're looking at a purchase. And increasingly, that third one is having a big, big sway on how much consumers are price sensitive and how loyal they are. So yeah, it's definitely something that Unilever spearheaded. And today, you know, brands like MasterCard are definitely leading the way. You know, MasterCard's work on financial inclusion is so integral to the brand. It has true authenticity. It's aligned with their product offering, but is laddered up to into a broader societal benefit in a very, very strategic way. And they also are looking at their responsibility from a sustainability perspective. Most brands in the world now have a net zero commitment. Unilever are looking to be net zero by 2030. Microsoft are looking to remove all of the carbon they've ever emitted by 2050. Major brands have these big commitments. And then in the EU, they will all have to report on it by January 2025 because of the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. There's this huge direction of travel. And then over the top of that, we've seen these massive moments in society. We talked about the pandemic. During that time, I certainly felt, and I think all people in our industry did, consumers were looking for brands to step up. You know, whether it was Nike doing workouts in our lounges or Uber Eats delivering meals to frontline workers, there was this sense of what's your role in society? And then we saw the massive rise of the Black Lives Matter movement and the death of George Floyd, this huge swell, this groundswell of activism for civil rights. And then in the last couple of years, growing momentum around sustainability. I mean, even in our industry, you know, AdNet Zero started in a pub in the UK back in 2020. And today it's a global consortium of all the biggest advertisers committed to make our industry net zero by 2030. Like, that momentum is amazing. And it's been an honor to be at the heart of it, really.
And let's dig in deeper about Good Loop and what you're doing there with your clients and the role that you're playing in that ecosystem.
Sure. So our big mission is to help brands do good through their media buying. This year, 2024, media buying will surpass $1 trillion for the first time ever. So $1 trillion is spent. And often when you think of like conscious consumerism, you think of like buying Patagonia or buying Ben and Jerry's. We think of individual people spending individual dollars. But imagine if the $1 trillion that we spend collectively could be consciously consumed, could be spent in ways that is good for business, you know, still drives attention and engagement and recall, but also good for the planet and good for the people who live on it. And so our big thesis is good media. You know, we've talked about brand safe media for 10 years now. We've talked about not funding terrorism, not funding hate speech, not funding bad news. We've talked about MFA. Lots of negative things we don't want our media to fund. Well, the other side of that coin is, what do we want to fund? Let's fund Black-owned publishers. Let's fund amazing charities and causes that align with your brand. Let's fund climate journalism. Let's fund those publishers that are taking action to reduce their emissions. So just thinking about more intentional flows of money through the media ecosystem. And we have a ton of different products that help brands do that super easily. And importantly, help them justify the ROI.
And it seems like a lot of UK companies, and we were very pleased and proud to support Stephen Woodford and the Advertising Association team. They launched AdNet Zero in America as part of Advertising Week a couple of years ago. Why do you think so much of this progressive thinking comes out of your native land?
It just rains a lot. We've got nothing else to do. We're stuck at home thinking about how we can make our world better. I think, like, I definitely, so I moved to New York a year ago. And it is palpable, the difference. At just a consumer level, the front of mind awareness of the climate crisis, the layers of plastic around my bananas and oranges that already have a skin is wild in this city. The amount of plastic and pollution and waste is incomparable to places in Europe where we've had years of investment in recycling and waste management. So I think there is just literally sort of societal differences in terms of what's been prioritized and what's been funded. And yeah, I guess from an industry perspective, the regulation has been a big driver. GDPR is a great example, right? GDPR came out of Europe and came out of a European sensibility for privacy and data protection, which then drove conversations in California, of course, but also, I think, you know, set a global standard by dint of being one of the biggest advertising markets in the world. You know, I see sustainability moving in a similar direction. We've got this corporate sustainable reporting directive coming from the EU, which means from 2025, January 2025, any company with over 50,000 employees in Europe, including international companies with 50,000 employees in Europe, will have to report publicly. They have to do a public inventory on their entire emissions flow, both their internal emissions, what's known as scope one and two, as well as the emissions from all of their partners and suppliers, what's known as scope three. So it may just be happening in Europe, but most global companies are so global that what's happening in Europe is still happening to them. So I think, yeah, it's a great place to sort of be the crux of change.
And you also led for a number of years the Sustainability Council out of the UK. And one of the stats that I thought was quite staggering is that the carbon footprint of our industry actually exceeds that of the airline industry. So there's an awful lot of ground to be made up. And I guess what I should ask is, that stat true? And let you answer.
It's almost, it's wild. I agree with you. It is mind-blowing. So the stat is that the internet has a larger carbon footprint than the airline industry. When you think about all of the planes flying around the world and the tangible, palpable sort of footprint that that has, we can understand that. We can get our hands around it. We can see it. The internet has a larger footprint than all of those planes. And that is where I think it starts to get really, really difficult for us to get our heads around, because you can't see the internet. You can't hold it, touch it. You can't see the damage it's doing. If anything, it saved all the trees that got cut down when we used to have paper. Like, in our heads, it's a good thing. But of course, the internet has all these server farms, all of these machines that are sat in some server farm in some desert somewhere that is using so much electricity and pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So the internet is 3% of global emissions. Now, from that, what percent is advertising? This stat varies depending on who you ask. The generally accepted rule of thumb is that about 25% of ad traffic comes from ads, but obviously it depends on so many variables. I think that is a good finger in the air, though. So, you know, when we're buying an ad on an end publisher's site, especially if you're using a programmatic infrastructure, you know, that publisher might have 20 supply side platforms that are selling those spaces. Those platforms are constantly bidding millions of times against multiple DSPs, plus all the resellers. Each of those are using a server. Each of those are using electricity. That's how it starts to add up.
Amazing. So I tried to calculate my carbon footprint a couple of years ago, and I thought, well, I'm going to score pretty high. I have an electric car. I do this, you know, I do. And then you get to the part with how much you fly, and it was over. Okay. So we're 6-7 years in now. Give us the current state. How is it going for you as a founder, a CEO, and really the heartbeat of Good Loop?
Oh, I'm having a lot of fun. I'm really proud of what we've built. So over the past 7 years, we've built three pillars of the business, three different products, three different ways that brands can do good through their media. The first is good formats. So this is really all focused on a consumer action. What do you want your consumer to do? Do you want them to not press that tempting skip button? Do you want them to swipe up on your Instagram story? Whatever that action is, we tie it to a donation. So we create a literal value exchange. If you give us a bit of your attention, you unlock a donation funded by the advertiser. And we've raised over $8 million for all sorts of charities. And I mean all sorts, like human rights campaigns and turtle nest mapping projects and everything in between. And that's money that, you know, otherwise would have gone to line Mark Zuckerberg's pockets. Like, that's something I'm really proud of. The second thing we do is good measures. So this is all about really moving our industry from ad suitability to ad responsibility, measuring and improving the footprint and the diversity and the impact of the media you're buying. So we, for example, we help brands measure their carbon footprint through a simple ad tag, and then we give them reduction tools so they can reduce their footprint by about 41% just by making some simple changes in how they buy. And then the third pillar is all about the publishers we fund, the inventory we fund. It's called good packages, and it's about packaging up inventory that is values aligned. So you can buy through a simple deal ID our Good for the Planet package, which is light green, clean publishers who have really low emissions pages, as well as climate journalism. So you can actually fund and be in that context. And then we have a Good for the People package, which is, again, a simple deal ID. That means you can really simply buy Black-owned publisher inventory, Hispanic-owned, female-owned, LGBTQ+-owned. So you can actually fund those communities and then get clear measurement back on how much of your media went to support them. So, yeah, lots of different things we're doing. All sorts of good stuff. It's really been fun to build out that breadth. You know, when Good Loot started, it was just one format and it was just watch to donate. And I think at the beginning, our power was in our simplicity. But as we've grown and as we've built that more holistic view, it's like it's a much more strategic thing now. And I'm really enjoying working with our key clients to sort of apply good media across every element of their media buy.
Well, it's a great, great story, and it's a tremendous growth story. I love what you're doing. I think it's fantastic. You must be pretty proud of yourself.
Some days I think, what the hell are you doing, Amy?
Well, listen, that's the entrepreneur's blessing and curse, right? Uh-huh. We don't allow ourselves those moments of pride, and we just think about what went wrong or what has to be done that hasn't
still
been done.
Still plenty
yet.
To do, yeah.
Absolutely. And post-COVID, is your world, are you back on airplanes and traveling, or is it a stay at home, work remote type of business?
We've been experimenting. I think this is one of the lovely things about building a business, is that I can build a business the way I think business should be run. We are a social impact company. We have a very clear social mission of like funding charities and funding important journalism. But I also see our internal operations as a social responsibility. So for example, we've been trialing a 9-day fortnight. So one Friday every other week, you get off. So it's just a much more work-life balance. And that's been something we're experimenting with. Another one is something what we call face-to-face days. So everybody works from wherever you're going to get your job done. Like, honestly, I don't care where you're sat as long as you get your job done. But 2 days a month, there's no external meetings. There's no Zoom calls. You are in the office. It is workshops, training, feedback, one-on-ones, all the stuff that you need each other in person, that human moment, and then a big team drinks or team lunch. So it's sort of 2 days a month where we invest in each other. And then the rest of the time you have that freedom and that flexibility, which has been really nice. It's been working really well in the UK. So yeah, still experimenting, but trying to lead by example and think differently about how business should operate.
Well, and I love that freedom and that empowerment of, I'm going to build it the way I think it should be built. And, you know, and I like that. And I think you have to have conviction and then stand behind that conviction. Well, Amy, this was such a joy. I love talking to you. I will come back to you and to Mary, who does such a good job for you. We have something new that we're doing in Boston around the intersection of the climate crisis and technology called Climate Tech. We've got Stephen Woodford involved. We've got Brian and the Scope 3 team involved. It's not advertising centric per se. It's a little bit bigger and broader. But I definitely think there's a slot for you, and you're a great speaker. If nothing else, I'd like to watch you on stage. So thanks so much for joining us on Great Minds. An absolute joy to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great day.